Hello and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, April 4th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. We'll start with a quick look at the weather. Today it's going to be mainly cloudy, breezy, and not as cold as yesterday with a high of 42 and a low of 28. Winds still will be out there though, north-northwest at 12 to 25 miles an hour. On tomorrow, Friday, the high of 45 and low of 27 will come with very sunny skies and a much lighter breeze, 7 to 14 miles an hour from the north-northeast. Saturday, a blend of sun and clouds, high 54, low of 37, winds 7 to 14 miles an hour from the southeast. Now, yesterday, if you were out there or trying to be out there, you'll know that we got 6.2 inches of snow, which is our monthly total to date. And the season to date is 46 inches. Now, as for those temperatures, you will feel that they're a little chillier than normal, but how does that compare with the norm across the years? Well, we see that in 1893, there was a record high of 80 degrees this date, and in 1954, a record low of 12 degrees. And if you're going to be out and about or know someone who is, they will have good air quality today. Moving to the Telegraph Herald's front page, the lead story, as it is in so many media reports right now, is called Bite Out of the Sun by Grace Nealon, and it has to do with the total solar eclipse that's upcoming. Jean Knapp remembers the overwhelming awe that comes from viewing a total solar eclipse. 7 years ago, she traveled from her home near Fenimore, Wisconsin, to a small town in Nebraska to watch the most recent solar eclipse that took place August 21st, 2017. The drive was long, she said, but more than worth it, saying, "Totality is almost a sort of spiritual experience. The sky darkens, and you can see the stars come out. It's just absolutely beautiful," end quote. Knapp hopes to recapture some of that magic during the upcoming solar eclipse set to take place Monday, April 8. She plans to view the event with a group of fellow astronomy fanatics at Effigy Mounds National Monument near Marquette, Iowa. She's unable to travel this year to the Path of Totality, where the moon blocks 100% of the sun, but she's hopeful the partial eclipse visible locally still will be a stunning sight. Knapp said, "It won't be the same, of course, but it'll still be nice to have a place to go and watch the eclipse with people who want to be looking up with you." For many, Monday will present a rare opportunity to see a consequential celestial event. Per NASA, the next total solar eclipse, visible from anywhere in the contiguous U.S., will not occur until August 23, 2024. A lot of people go through their whole life without getting a chance to see a total solar eclipse, said Kenneth McLaughlin, director of Loras College's Heitkamp Planetarium. "You either have to be pretty lucky," he said, "to have to pass it over you, have it pass over you, or you have to travel," end quote. An eclipse occurs when the moon passes between the sun and the earth, blocking out the sun's light. An eclipse can be partial or total, and each is only visible from a limited region of Earth. Typically, the path of a total eclipse is quite narrow and covers less than 1% of the Earth's surface. Prior to 2017, the last total eclipse visible from anywhere in the contiguous U.S. was in 1979. The tri-state area is not in the path of totality for Monday's eclipse, so area viewers instead will see a partial eclipse. In Dubuque, the eclipse will begin at about 12:45 p.m. Monday and end at about 3:15 p.m., peaking at around 2 p.m. at roughly 86% coverage. McLaughlin said it's not totality, but at peak coverage, we'll still see the moon take a significant bite out of the sun. Many area libraries, including Dubuque's Carnegie Stout Public Library, have protective eclipse glasses available for free while supplies last. Glasses also can be repurchased at a variety of area businesses, including Walmart and Hy-Vee. And finally, a live stream of the solar eclipse will be available for viewing on the Telegraph Herald website Monday at telegraphherald.com/eclipse. Reporter Benjamin Fisher gives us our next story on the Telegraph Herald's front page. Primary results in southwest Wisconsin tell local story. Wisconsin's presidential primary results show the ways voters in Grant and Lafayette counties aligned with and differed from voters for each major party statewide, with the state expected to have significant influence in November's election. Statewide results from Tuesday's primary showed some general trends in which Southwest Wisconsin voters joined. More area Republicans participated in the primary than Democrats, and a sizable minority of voters did not cast a ballot for the party's, that's plural, presumptive nominees. Voters in Grant and Lafayette County differed from those statewide in other ways. While President Joe Biden received more total votes than former President Donald Trump statewide, Trump garnered more votes than Biden in local counties. Wisconsin's impact on the presidential election is expected to be substantial due to its electorate swinging evenly between Democrat and Republican candidates. The state's presidential primary is late enough that Biden and Trump were already their party's presumptive nominee before Wisconsinites canceled their ballots. So the state's voting data can be telling for other reasons, said Loras College political science professor Chris Budzigs. There are caution signs for both Biden and Trump in these election results, Chris said. This election in Wisconsin could come down to a few hundred votes here and a few hundred votes there in places like Grant County and Lafayette County and a few thousand statewide. In the primary, Biden received over 30,000 more votes than Trump, 505,969 to 472,226 as of late Wednesday morning when the last votes still were being counted. Southwest Wisconsin stood apart from the state as a whole by that metric. In Grant County, Trump received 4,184 votes to Biden's 3,557, and in Lafayette County, Trump received 1,253 to Biden's 1,064. Tuesday's primary was not a contest between just the party's presumptive nominees, though. Statewide, Biden received about 43.3% of total votes cast across both parties, to Trump's 40.5%. In Grant County, Trump received 44.7% of the total vote to Biden's 38%, and in Lafayette County, Trump received 47.6% to Biden's 40.4%. That means voters in Tuesday's primary, about 16% statewide, 17% in Grant County, and 12% in Lafayette County, chose either another candidate or no candidate, despite both parties' presumptive nominees having no official opponent. Biden received 88.5% of Democratic primary votes statewide. He received 3,557 votes, or 89.4% in Grant County, and 1,064, or 93.2% in Lafayette. Ahead of Tuesday's primary, a group of vocal Democrat-leaning Wisconsin voters joined a movement to vote against Biden over his administration's role in the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. Political experts were watching how many voters would cast uninstructed ballots in the Democrats' primary, which in Wisconsin means none of the above. Statewide, 47,847 Democrats voted uninstructed. Biden won Wisconsin over Trump in 2020 by just around 20,000 votes. U.S. Representative Dean Phillips, Democrat of Minnesota, received 17,553 votes. In Grant County, 215 Democratic voters chose uninstructed. In Lafayette County, 45 chose uninstructed. Phillips received 169 votes in Grant County and 32 votes in Lafayette County. Overall, 10.6% of Democratic voters in Grant County and 6.8% in Lafayette County chose an option other than Biden in the party's primary. That was lower than the 11.4% of voters in the Democrat primary statewide. Democratic Party of Wisconsin Chair Ben Wickler said in a release Tuesday night, "Today, Wisconsinites turned out in force to make their voices heard, delivering a resounding victory for President Joe Biden in the Democratic primary and racking up tens of thousands more votes than Trump." More voters in Grant and Lafayette counties chose a Republican presidential candidate than the 51% of voters statewide. Trump received 79.2% of Republican primary votes statewide, as well as 78% in Grant County and 84% in Lafayette County. Trump was the only Republican candidate on Tuesday's ballot to still be campaigning. Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy all received some votes, though all suspended their campaigns after failing to beat Trump in earlier caucuses or primaries. Republicans could also choose uninstructed in their primary. In Grant County, 22.4% of Republican voters chose an option other than Trump. That exceeds the 20.8% of Republican voters who did statewide and the 16% who did in Lafayette County. Grant County GOP President Bill Byfer said, "I wasn't surprised by Nikki Haley's votes. I was pretty certain they wouldn't change. Some of the others did surprise me." Among Republicans other than Trump, Haley received by far the most support, including 668 votes in Grant County and 143 in Lafayette. As in most other state primaries, DeSantis received next most among Trump alternatives. Many Republican voters also chose uninstructed, 12,832 statewide, 141 in Grant, and 29 in Lafayette County. Budzig said Tuesday's results included more potential bad news for Trump than for Biden, largely because he thought Democrats' uninstructed votes were less significant than a vote for another candidate. He said, "Uninstructed votes, I imagine, for some people are a protest, but that number Biden received in Wisconsin is smaller than in some other states. That vote seems to be more symbolic than choosing someone else. But if you are the Biden campaign, that's not helpful either, because you are hoping this is a done deal." For Trump, Budzig said a continued lack of support this far into primary season could be cause for concern, saying, "There isn't some coordinated campaign for uninstructed against Trump. Haley hasn't been running a campaign for forever in political terms, and yet Trump didn't cross that 80% threshold in an essentially uncontested primary. The vast majority of those voters will probably come back into the Republican fold, but if they decide they are going to continue their opposition, that's a problem for Trump." Finally, on the Telegraph Herald's front page is this article from Elizabeth Kelsey under the title "Local Colleges Adapt to FAFSA, F-A-F-S-A, Delays." Local colleges are giving families more time than usual to make enrollment decisions amid ongoing issues and delays with a new federal application through which students can receive financial aid. The U.S. Department of Education late last year released an updated version of the Free Application for Federal Student Aid form, it's called FAFSA or FAFSA, which current and prospective college students complete to determine their eligibility for financial aid from both the federal government and their college. The rollout has been plagued by delays and technical glitches, and the department began sending financial data to some colleges only last month. Institutions are pressed for time to complete financial aid packages for students, many of whom remain unsure how much aid they will receive. Many schools nationwide have extended their enrollment deadlines out from the typical May 1st commitment date, and some local colleges, including University of Dubuque and Loras, have followed suit. Staff at other area institutions are working to support families and answer questions during the admissions period. Director of Financial Aid Robert Hoover of Clark University said, "We are about 6 months behind, essentially, and classes still start at the same time in the fall, so right now we're knee-deep in it, but it seems like the wheels are finally starting to get moving, which is nice to see." Congress in 2020 approved updates to the FAFSA, including reducing the number of questions it asks and using a new formula expected to make more students eligible for federal Pell Grants and loans, college grants, and scholarships. The new form was required by law to be available January 1st. Already a delay from the October 1st date FAFSA applications typically open each year. While it was released in a soft launch by December 30th, it was only available for short periods of time until over a week later. In late January, the Department of Education made a last-minute fix to the form to account for the latest inflation data in calculations, and families and students have reported various technical glitches throughout the spring. Applicants who need to make changes or corrections to an already submitted form also have not yet been able to do so, which is causing further delays. Robert Broshaus, Vice President for Enrollment Management and Dean of Admissions at UD said literally every week there have been new data elements that need corrections that have really prevented us from being able to provide students an accurate estimate of what it's going to cost to attend. And there are very few students who don't need to know what it's going to cost before they decide where they're going to school. Laura's Vice President for Student Development, Arthur Sunleaf, said the institution typically begins sharing financial aid packages with students by January, if not late December. Due to the ongoing FAFSA issues, Laura still has not been able to do so, though officials there hope to begin that process in the next 2 to 3 weeks. Sunleaf said, "We're doing everything we can up to being able to release the package because we are still waiting to get that accurate information. At least now, families do know their FAFSA has been processed, but there's still that pause to make sure the pieces are correct." In response, Loras extended its admissions deadlines by 1 month to June 1st. And this week, UD announced it would do the same. Brosshaus said UD has received some federal data and was able to send out about 200 financial planning awards to students this week, but officials believed they would not be able to provide all students with that information in time for the typical May deadline. Sunleaf and Brosshaus said they are unsure whether the delays will impact their school's fall enrollment, though they noted that the number of students who have committed to both UD and Loras this spring is on track with last year's figures. In a typical year, over 17 million students submit the FAFSA. As of late February, around 4.7 million forms had been submitted, according to the U.S. Department of Education. At Clark, Hoover said the school's number of committed students for the fall is lower than in past years, but officials are cautiously optimistic that class size is still shaping up well. Staff in Clark's admissions office have reached out to families with worksheets to help prospective students make an educated estimate on how much aid they will receive, even if their FAFSA is not yet finalized. They also are communicating with families who are waiting to make corrections to their FAFSA and will continue to enroll students throughout the summer as they typically do. UW-Platteville also admits students on an ongoing basis throughout the summer as part of the institution's rolling admissions program. Communications Director Allison Parkins wrote in an email Wednesday, "We continue to operate as normal, and our enrollment and financial aid teams are working closely with prospective students and families to address questions." As we move to the next page, Dubuque and Tri-State section, we start with this article titled, "Next Western Dubuque High School Principal Seeks, quote, continual improvement," end quote. This is also from Elizabeth Kelsey. Dateline Epworth. Ethan Lynch believes he has much to look forward to as the newly appointed principal of Western Dubuque High School. He said, there's great staff at the district level and at the building level, so it's more about coming in and focusing on that continual improvement. We're already a great school, and my job is to support that." End quote. Lynch will serve as the high school's principal beginning July 1st, pending approval by the school board. He will succeed Jacob Feldman, who recently was appointed to serve in the newly created role of Director of Secondary Education for the district. Lynch is currently high school principal in the Adair Casey and Guthrie Center School District, a role he has held for the past 4 years in Iowa. He has worked in the district for a total of 8 years, serving previously as the at-risk coordinator for 2 years, and then as assistant principal and activities director and as an instructional coach. When he became aware of the open principal position in Western Dubuque, Lynch said he was initially impressed by what he saw at the Epworth High School, saying, "There's lots of good things that go on there, both academically and extracurricular activities. It checks all the boxes, and I didn't really have to think twice," end quote. Lynch described himself as a go-getter who's not easily ruffled and is able to make clear decisions while keeping students and staff in mind, saying, "As a principal, I work mostly with the teachers who have the direct impact on students, so my leadership style is just finding ways to support them and focus on their growth, goals, and how I can help them get better. How can I make them comfortable and build that rapport and respect and trust?" End quote. Western Dubuque Superintendent Dan Butler said Lynch displayed a people-first, relationship-driven mindset during the interview process, along with a focus on continual growth that pairs well with the district's overall growth. Butler said of Lynch, "He's someone that really cares about people, whether that is students, families, or the greater community, and someone who's committed to providing opportunities for all people connected to Western Dubuque." Since I don't often have the opportunity to read with you for the Telegraph Herald, I'm not sure what other readers do, but there is this Throwback Thursday article included in this local news section. And that Throwback Thursday article I'm going to read today, it's from Eric Hogstrom, and it's titled "Dutch Elm Disease Cases Rose 60 Years Ago in Dubuque." The article reads, "Cases of a lethal fungal disease that wiped out millions of North American trees were increasing 60 years ago in Dubuque. Dutch elm disease made its first Dubuque appearance in August 1961 when an infected tree was discovered on Hill Street. The disease spread throughout the city during the course of the decade. At the beginning of the 60s, 85% of Dubuque's trees were elms. The disease destroyed hundreds of trees, including those that once lined Romberg Avenue. Disease-resistant trees have been planted in recent years to partly replenish the city's elms." And this is how the Telegraph Herald reported on the local increase of diseased trees in its April 4, 1964 edition. It was titled then, "Elm Disease in Dubuque to Increase, Officials Say." Things are going to get much worse before they improve when it comes to Dutch elm disease in Dubuque, in the estimation of a park official. Dubuque Park Superintendent Richard Kramer said, "All we are doing is slowing down Dutch elm disease," referring to the department's program of tree sanitation. He continued, "Our city chemist, Art Roth Jr., said, right now there's no cure for this disease, and it's becoming more rampant. Last year," I guess that would have been 1963, "a total of 150 cases of the tree malady were found in Dubuque, nearly six times the toll from 1961 and 62, when 27 cases were discovered. No section of the city was spared from the disease, and some areas such as Flatiron Park at Jones, South Main, and Shield Streets were left barren by the tree malady. The park department began planting trees to replace the diseased trees last fall. During the fall and winter, department employees continued removing dead wood from trees and taking out stumps of diseased trees cut down last summer during the height of the epidemic. The dead wood is removed because it provides a good nesting place for the elm bark beetle, carrier of the disease. Dutch elm disease is caused by a fungus that grows in the water-conducting tissues of the tree. When fungus spores are deposited in an elm by the beetles, they germinate and grow. The materials produced by the fungus interfere with normal sapwood functions and stimulate production of gums and other substances by the tree. Those substances plug the water-conducting vessels, eventually causing tree death. The disease also can spread from an infected tree to neighboring elms through natural root grafts. That fact caused some concern when Dutch elm disease was discovered last year in several trees along Romberg Avenue, shaded by an archway of elms. The trees often are infected shortly after the sap begins to flow in the spring, but the first signs are not detected until early June. Most obvious indications of the tree malady are yellowing and falling leaves. When a tree is found to be diseased, it is cut down quickly by park crews if it is on public property. Owners of property on which diseased trees are found are given notice to have them removed within 15 days to help prevent disease spread. After the trees are cut down, the logs are burned to destroy any of the beetles which might remain." Also in the Tri-State section, this article from Aaron LaBelle titled, "Donated Cake Pans Added to Menu of Items at Hopkinton Library." And the dateline is, of course, Hopkinton, Iowa. Hopkinton continues to be a place of collaboration following the recent donation of over 60 cake pans to the Hopkinton Public Library. Hopkinton City Clerk Sarah Hell is the benefactor of the new Cake Pan Lending Library, and her generosity is an example of the partnership between city departments and the rural Delaware County Library. Helly also donated decorating tools and two organizational binders filled with photographs and instructions, which serve as a catalog guiding patrons through creating the cake of their dreams. Sections are labeled with themes, including characters, holidays, shapes, sports, and animals. Helly said, I used to do daycare, and when I was younger, my mom used to make cakes for me. I baked cakes for my daughter. I kept finding them at the not-so-tiny house mission store, so I became a cake pan collector. I liked the idea of sharing, because people here will put them to use and appreciate them, end quote. Library Director Kim Albright is excited about the new lending library, and she hopes to make life even better for library patrons and the greater community, saying, maybe we'll reach a new part of the population, because our goal is to reach as many people as possible and offer as many resources as possible. I used one of the pans to make a puppy print cake for my son's birthday, she said. Helly admits to collecting all kinds of weird things at the local thrift store, saying, I like to collect, and I have boxes of weird things I've found at the tiny house. My mom collects banks, so I always look for them, as well as odd treasures I don't necessarily want on display in my home. For example, a clay mariachi band doesn't fit well with my decor, she said, adding she's currently focused on collecting milk glass. Albright added, if I need something for a library program, I know I can always get it from Sarah. Helly is proposing a possible future cake decorating program. Albright said, Sarah and I have a tight working relationship because everyone recognizes we're working toward the same goal. We've built trusting relationships. Our collaboration with city departments isn't common in other places, maybe because of control issues and money. We have respect for each other. The library board and I are grateful for the city and Sarah. End quote. Helly said, I respect what Kim does for the city, and she respects what I do. Last night I texted her about an idea for an event. We're a good team. It's a small town, so the library has to be about more than books, end quote. That sentiment rings true for Albright. One day, over 100 people attended a monkey program at the small library. That's right, a monkey program. After that, Albright knew the facility needed more space, so she began using the community center across the street. The library now uses it frequently for large group activities such as cupcake wars and puzzle palooza. Albright said, programming is my baby. I love to find new things to offer the community. The more things going on in Hopkinton, the better, Albright said. And there is a lovely picture of Kim Albright and City Clerk Sarah Helly showing off a bunch of their cake pans. My goodness, there are ones in the shape of teddy bears and puppy dogs and stars and the puppy print. And looks like a football helmet, maybe. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, quite a variety that are apparently now available through the Hopkinton Lending Library. We have here a pretty lengthy article on results of elections in Southwest Wisconsin. I'll just read an excerpt just in the interest of time. Southwest Wisconsin voters on Tuesday approved a school district capital measure and elected a slate of county, city, and school district leaders. Fenimore area voters approved a $17 million capital measure in a referendum for Fenimore Community Schools. A total of 669 people, or 65.8%, voted in favor of the measure, while 34.2% voted against it. The district intends to borrow the funds over the next 20 years to support projects such as roof replacements and additional air conditioning at both the elementary and middle and high school buildings, as well as classroom remodels and accessibility improvements. They then offer a very lengthy list of results that previously had not been reported in the Telegraph Herald for various local positions and roles. I will just tell you, as I look at it based on the formatting they show, overwhelmingly incumbents were re-elected to their position. And I certainly don't mean to shortchange anything, but it is such a lengthy list, and I'm hopeful that you will have other media resources to be able to get the specifics that are of interest to you. There is, however, a brief political article about an outcome of an election. It's not anywhere near us. It is from Carew F. Daniels, reprinted from the New York Daily News, and it's titled, Martin Short Will Be the Next Mayor of Funner, F-U-N-N-E-R, California, Population 1500. Martin Short's next gig will be the mayor of Funner, California. The two-time Emmy Award-winning Only Murders in the Building star will be inaugurated on Monday, May 13th, as the next city leader of the small town, home of the sprawling Harrah's Resort, Southern California, maybe that's Harrah's, about 1 hour northeast of downtown San Diego. Short will serve a 2-year term in the position. Past officials include David Hasselhoff and, most recently, Jane Lynch, who co-starred in the hit Hulu series. Martin Short said, "As the mayor-elect of Funner, I promise to be more than just a spokesperson dressed in purple from head to toe, but instead the best mayor in the whole darn state," he said in a statement with the announcement. "It's my goal to make every part of the already fun Harrah's Resort SoCal even funner, and I can't wait to share my plans with all of my constituents in just 6 short weeks," end quote. The 74-year-old funny man will officially be sworn into office and given the key to Funner on May 13th. On that day, the 4th mayor is also expected to announce his forthcoming plans for the 1,500-population city. Funner, once part of the Valley Center, California, was officially renamed in 2016 by the Rincon Tribe, which runs the Native American Casino Resort. Short promises to take the oath to work with Funner City Council, quote, "to protect fun, good times, laughing out loud, and positive vibes from the negative influences, determined to turn a smile upside down," end quote. And I hope that brought a smile to your face. As I remind you, you're listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, April 4th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we will turn to today's obituaries. We'll take a look first at the shorter notices. In Clarksville, Tennessee, Elizabeth M. Luna, age 89, of Clarksville and formerly of Cuba City, Wisconsin, died Tuesday, April 2nd. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, April 9th at Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cuba City and from 10 to 10:45 p.m. Wednesday, April 10th at Rose of Lima Church in Cuba City, where services will follow. Burial will be at Evergreen Cemetery in Prairie du Chien. Andrea M. Ryan, age 72, of Dubuque, died yesterday. Visitation will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, April 7th at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, April 8th at St. Joseph's Key West Church. And John P. Sturman, S-T-U-R-M-A-N, age 90, of New Bern, North Carolina, died Wednesday, March 27th. I'm assuming he previously had been a resident of Dubuque. A committal service will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, April 6th at Linwood Cemetery in Dubuque. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is assisting the family. Continuing with the lengthy obituaries, Paul G. McAndrews, age 89, of Dubuque, passed away April 1st at Mercy One Dubuque. Family and friends may visit from 9 to 11 a.m. this Saturday, April 6th, at Mary Frances Clark Chapel, Mount Carmel Bluffs, 1040 Carmel Drive. Mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 6th. Burial will be in Holy Family Cemetery in New Melray. Bear Funeral Home is assisting the family. The family requests no flowers, but those who wish to do so may provide memorials to the BVM Sisters and the Veterans Freedom Center. Cards may be mailed to the family care of Bear Funeral Home and with the attention of Paul McAndrew's family. From Dyersville, Anna J. Drees, D-R-E-E-S, age 95, passed away yesterday, April 3rd, at Hawkeye Care Center in Dubuque. Visitation will be from 9 to 10:30 a.m. this Saturday, April 6th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville prior to the funeral mass. A mass of Christian burial will follow at 11 a.m. at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, with burial in the church cemetery. The family issues a public thank you to the Ellen Kennedy Center, Hawkeye Care Center and Hospice of Dubuque for what they describe as wonderful care of Anna, and they say the memorials may be sent to the family in care of Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Daryl Ernster, also known as Buddy, age 92, of Asbury, died Tuesday, March 26th at the Luther Manor in Dubuque. Visitation will be from 9 to 11:15 Saturday, April 6th at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, with a funeral service at 11:30 a.m. at the funeral home. Burial will be in Resurrection Cemetery in Dubuque. That funeral will be on April 6th. The family issues a public thank you to Hospice of Dubuque, Luther Manor, and Dr. Sullivan, who was with us through the entire journey of caring for Buddy. There are a number of funeral service announcements. I will go through them in case someone that you know is going to have a celebration of life or funeral. Eunice M. Bowers of Savannah, Illinois. That visitation will be 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 6th at Savannah Bible Church with a service at 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. Beverly Brandt of Galena. Visitation 10 a.m. to noon today. So that's probably too late. I'm sorry. The Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena with a service at noon today at the chapel. Elizabeth Christ of Asbury. Visitation will be next Tuesday, April 9th, Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory. Prayer service will be at the funeral home 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, and then the funeral will be at Resurrection Catholic Church on Wednesday, April 10th at 10:30 a.m. Patricia Green of Monona, visitation 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, April 5th at Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Monona with the services Saturday, April 6th at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Monona. Daniel Haas of Lancaster, Wisconsin, visitation Friday from 9 to noon at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster. A celebration of life will be held for Arthur Landon of Dubuque, 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, April 6th at Luther Manor Clubhouse. For Rosalie M. Lowes of Dubuque, visitation tomorrow, Friday, 3 to 7 p.m. at Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque, Illinois, with Mass of Christian Burial, Saturday, April 6th, 10:30 a.m. at St. Joseph's Church, Key West. Greg Marcotte of Schulzburg, Wisconsin, celebration of life will be held 11 to a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, April 6th at Haudenschild Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cuba City. For Francis A. Marshall of Bernard, Iowa, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. tomorrow, Friday, Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory in Dubuque, with a service at the funeral home at 10 a.m. April 6th. Josh Miller of Bellevue, the visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. today, Thursday, Hochman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation in Bellevue, with a service Friday, April 5th, 10:30 a.m. at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Bellevue. Shirley M. Moody of Dubuque, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 5th at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home on Asbury Road in Dubuque. We will wrap up this portion of the reading together with some happier news. We'll announce a few births. Monday, April 1st in Mettinger. No, I'm sorry, the Mettingers, Brian and Kelsey of Bellevue, Iowa, had a boy at Unity Point Health Finley Hospital in Dubuque. Dylan Dean and Lily Hefner welcomed a girl at Finley Hospital. Then on Tuesday, April 2nd, the Knapps, Andy and Megan of Cascade, said hello to their brand new little baby boy. Malik Patterson and Sandra Manwill of Dubuque welcomed a girl at Finley, also at the Finley Hospital, busy hospital. Jonathan Beltran Jara and Ashley Beltran Escobar of Dubuque welcomed a girl. And then on Wednesday, just yesterday, Joel and Molly Thomason of Elizabeth, Illinois, welcomed their little girl at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. And the Telegraph Herald also gives us notice of a few birthdays today. If today is your birthday, happy birthday. Among celebrities that you share a birthday with is recording executive Clive Davis, who's 92. Author Kitty Kelly is 82. Actor Craig Nelson is celebrating today his 80th birthday. Actor Christine Lottie is 74. And country singer Steve Gatlin of the Gatlin Brothers is 73. Writer-producer David Kelly is 68. Actor Hugh Weaving is 64. Robert Downey Jr. is turning 59. And Nancy McKeon, you may remember her from some TV shows back in the day, she's 58 today. And country singer Clay Davidson is 53. And next, let's move over to prep sports so we can keep you apprised of what's going on at that local level. We have an article here about boys prep soccer for the River Valley Conference. This is written by Tim O'Neill. I'll read excerpts from it. Tim says, the River Valley Conference is one of the toughest small school soccer conferences in Iowa. It isn't easy to reach the top of the standings, but the battles during the regular season can lead to big things in late May and early June. At least that's the hope for the four area teams competing in the RVC. Dyersville-Beckman Catholic will be looking for a return to state, while Bellevue and Cascade are still in the early stages of their program, and Maquoketa is set to emerge from a rebuild. And then he provides a capsule look at the area teams. For Bellevue, he says the Comets are entering just their second season as a standalone program, following a long run as a co-op with Bellevue Marquette. This could be an exciting season in Bellevue, with 8 returning starters, 6 seniors, and a sophomore class that could provide a big impact. The Comets are hoping to reach the 500 mark and finish the season with momentum that could lead to a deep playoff run. As for Cascade, the Cougars enter their 4th season as a program looking to build on the momentum generated at the end of last season when they won their final 3 matches heading to the sub-state tournament. Depth figures to be a strength with an influx of new talent, giving Cascade the opportunity to give players more rest and the ability to overcome injuries. The loss of 3 starters along the defensive line will be the focus for improvement early in the season. As for Beckman, the Trailblazers have been the area's most consistent program over the last decade, but are still trying to get back to its glory days of 2015-16 when they won back-to-back state championships without losing a match. This team has the making of another solid squad, with 9 players who made at least 10 starts last year, and nearly all of its goals from last season back this spring. The Blazers still have a young squad with just 2 seniors in the lineup, so this could be the start of another nice run in Dyersville. And finally, as for Maquoketa, it's been a rough several seasons for the Cardinals, who won at least 10 games in consecutive seasons in 2016-17, but have just 11 in the 5 completed seasons since. This season could break that trend for Maquoketa, which returns all of its scoring and its top goalkeeper. And there's a similarly structured article for Boys Prep Track and Field for the River Valley Conference, this one written by Danny Miller, and once again I'll give you some excerpts from it. Danny says, with 6 state experienced athletes back in the fold, Bellevue is poised for another strong outdoor track and field season in 2024. Cascade and Maquoketa also return athletes that competed on the Blue Oval. Dyersville-Beckman, with increased numbers, has hopes of reaching Des Moines this season. And so for a capsule look at area boys track and field teams competing in the River Valley Conference this season, we have Bellevue, where the Comets bring back Tath, Manders, and Gunther from the Class 1A 4x400 team that took bronze at last year's state meet. Tath also competed individually in the 200 and 400. Dunn and Kilburg also participated in Des Moines. Greibel, a 2-time state medalist, who missed last year's state championships with an injury, will be among the top 1A distance runners in the state. Bellevue will have depth in distance, sprints, and hurdles, but be inexperienced in jumps and throws. For Cascade, they return 3 athletes with previous state meet experience. Hosh was part of the 4x100, 4x2, and 4x400 and sprint medley last year in Des Moines, while Casey ran in the 4x2, 4x4, and competed individually in the 400 hurdles and high jump. Cook qualified in the 4x800 in 2022 as a freshman. The Cougars feature a nice balance of veteran leadership and promising underclassmen that should make them competitive this spring. For Dyersville-Beckman, the Trailblazers didn't feature any athletes at last year's state meet, but have high hopes for this season behind a solid nucleus that showed promise during the indoor season. Klusner and Sigworth will be looked to lead the sprinters, while Solrin and Schlarman will front the distance runners. Schulte, a senior, will head an increased number of throwers out for track this season. And finally, very briefly for Maquoketa, Harden, Meyer, and Tranel ran on the Cardinals 3A sprint medley team that placed 7th last year at state. Harden competed individually in the 3A 100 and 200, and there's a photo here for Bellevue's Casey Tath competing in the 400 meter dash during last season's Iowa Class 1A state track meet in Des Moines. And here's a couple of news tidbits from Manchester. Delaware County Treasurer to retire in May. Pam Klein wrote in an email to the Telegraph Herald that she plans to retire May 3rd from her elected position. She has served as treasurer since March 2017 and served 40 years total in the treasurer's office. Delaware County Supervisor Shirley Helmrichs said the county board will appoint someone to fill the remainder of Klein's term and they won't be wasting any time. She said, "We will appoint someone at a meeting held 1 minute after her retirement is official. We want there to be continuity of services." Police have said they're investigating a suspicious vehicle fire in Dubuque. The fire occurred about 4:50 a.m. Sunday in the 2100 block of Jackson Street. Dubuque Police Department Lieutenant Luke Bach said the vehicle is considered a total loss. There was damage to the front and back with the back windshield broken, end quote. Police said the vehicle was worth $2,800. Bach said police are investigating the case as arson. There have been no arrests. And from the police log, a case of wire fraud resulting in the theft of $2,000 was reported by the Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Departments on Monday. This occurred in the 2000 block of Rockdale Road. Also in Dubuque, criminal damage of $500 to a window was reported Sunday in the 1200 block of Bluff Street. And last Friday, a fraud case resulting in the theft of $900 was reported in the 12,000 block of Carina Court. And from the Public Information Department, you or someone you know may be interested that Dyersville Parks and Rec is launching a community garden. 20 plots are available for a season that runs from May 1st to October 15th at the garden, located in the green space north of the alley of 3rd Street Northwest, according to an online announcement. The garden is intended and designed to foster a sense of community and enhance food security. Plots measure approximately 15 by 20 feet and will be leased for an annual fee of $20 per plot. Tilling and soil testing will be completed prior to the growing season. If you or someone you know is interested, you can call Adam Hunergarth, Community Garden Coordinator, for more information at 563-875-7724. That's 563-875-7724. And another food-related item from Dyersville. James Kennedy Public Library in Dyersville will be hosting a grab-and-go breakfast burrito fundraiser this weekend. The event marks National Library Week and will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. this Saturday, April 6th, at the library at 320 First Avenue East. Egg, sausage, and cheese burritos will be available for $5 each, and proceeds will support library services and collections. And it is certainly obvious that spring has sprung. My goodness, there are so many options for things to do. And I don't know about you, but sometimes even when I can't participate, just makes me happier to know there's so much available. So some of the choices are there's going to be an orchestra concert this evening. Classics 5 Transcending Boundaries, the Dubuque Symphony Orchestra featuring Terrence Tam on violin will be 7:30 p.m. Saturday, April 6th, and then 2 p.m. Sunday, April 7th. It's going to be at the Five Flags Theater, 405 Main Street. Tickets do cost $20 to $89. There will be Violin Concerto in D Major featuring Terrence Tam on violin. It's a Tchaikovsky piece. And then Symphony No. 5 in D Minor, Shostakovich. There will be pre- and post-concert events Friday, tomorrow, April 5th at 11:30 a.m., Sound Bites Dubuque Golf and Country Club, 800 Randall Place. That cost is $20. And then I suppose those who go to the concert might want to stick around. Saturday, April 6th, there will be an encore reception that is free at the Five Flags Center Promenade. There will also be a free post-concert for the Sunday, April 7th event. That'll be at 1 p.m. Musical Musings. Oh, this will be a pre-concert lecture at the Five Flags Theater for free. So the way that was presented in the article is just a little bit confusing, but I hope you got the key points from it. There's also an opportunity to participate in a food drive that will be held April 13th. Local Boy Scouts will hold their annual Scouting for Food collection later this month. It'll be held April 13th, so not too far away. Donations will benefit local pantries in Dubuque. Scouts will collect food from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the three Hy-Vee locations. Scouts will collect bags of food set out on residents' doorsteps beginning at 9 a.m. in East Dubuque, Bellevue, Iowa, Epworth, Iowa, Farley, and Piasta, Iowa. Additional collection points from 9 to noon include Bellevue Community Center, the Dyersville Fairway Dollar Fresh and Randy's Neighborhood Market, the East Dubuque, Illinois Food Pantry, Epworth, Iowa Silker's Grocery will have those available for collection, and in Piasta, the Fairway. Donated items must be non-perishable, and they say their top needs are peanut butter, jelly, soup, applesauce, coffee, pancake mix and syrup, tuna and canned meat, stuffing mix, pasta and sauce, macaroni and cheese, shampoo, body wash, toothpaste, and toothbrushes. In a reprint from the Associated Press, the Telegraph Herald advises of a new informed consent requirement for certain medical procedures. Hospitals must obtain written informed consent from patients before subjecting them to pelvic exams and exams of other sensitive areas, especially if an exam will be done while the patient is unconscious, the federal government said Monday. New guidance from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services now requires consent for breast, pelvic, prostate, and rectal exams for educational and training purposes performed by medical students, nurse practitioners, or physician assistants. The department's release said the guidance was issued to reiterate and provide clarity regarding hospital consent requirements. Federal regulations previously mentioned obtaining consent for important tasks related to surgeries, but did not provide the level of detail about medical students. If hospitals don't obtain explicit consent, they may be ineligible for participation in Medicare and Medicaid programs and subject to fines and investigations if they violate patient privacy laws. Doctors and med students sometimes perform exams of sensitive areas for training purposes when a patient is under anesthesia. At least 20 states have passed laws requiring patient consent. The HHS secretary and other top health officials criticized these exams happening without explicit consent in a letter sent to teaching hospitals and medical schools Monday. The letter said hospitals need to set clear guidelines to ensure providers and trainees performing these examinations first obtain and document informed consent. It's difficult to say how often these exams take place, experts said, or how often patients understand what they're consenting to when they sign forms before surgery, giving broad consent to a range of procedures. Scott Berkowitz, founder and president of the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, said in a statement, "The letter is a critical leap forward in protecting patients and medical residents. It's a shocking problem with a very simple solution. Hospitals need to ask for consent clearly and explicitly," end quote. Alexandra Fontaine, a medical student at Ohio University who testified in front of a state house committee against the practice, was skeptical that the letter would result in actual policy or real change, but added it made her feel more protected and respected. She said, "Something like that happening is my biggest fear. As women, we're all afraid of being violated on a daily basis, but when we're put in very vulnerable positions like being anesthetized, I think that's especially terrifying," end quote. And one last article about health. It's under the title Banishing Bad Breath, and it is a King Features contribution from Michael Roizen and Mehmet Oz. Halitosis is reportedly a common character on Hollywood sets. Kissing Clark Gable in Gone with the Wind was not that exciting, according to co-star Vivian Leigh. His dentures smelled something awful. And on the set of the 1999 movie Forces of Nature, Sandra Bullock is rumored to have given Ben Affleck a box of breath mints. Some studies indicate that bad breath plagues almost a third of all folks. It often results from poor oral hygiene, not brushing and flossing regularly. When it's chronic, it can be a sign of gum disease, acid reflux, diabetes, liver and kidney disease, H. pylori, which is associated with stomach ulcer, and dry mouth from certain meds. And then they list three steps to mitigate it. One, prevent bad breath by brushing two or three times a day, flossing daily, and cleaning your tongue with your brush or a tongue scraper. Step two, if you still have bad breath, you need to see your dentist to determine if you might have gingivitis or periodontal disease. It's important to reverse those since it's linked to an increased risk for dementia, as well as respiratory disease, rheumatoid arthritis, coronary artery disease, preterm birth and low birth weight, and problems controlling blood sugar in diabetes, according to the Mayo Clinic. Finally, if gingivitis or periodontal disease are not the problem, see your primary care physician to explore other medical issues that might be the cause. Then you can breathe easy. That does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, April 4th. I've been your reader, Mary Neff. It's been a pleasure to read with you. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And as always, we thank you for listening.